All right, why don't we, I guess, get started here. This is the workshop in the book of Esther, so if you're looking for something else, you're in the wrong room. Now, hopefully a question that has come to mind thinking of a workshop in the book of Esther is, why the book of Esther for a conference on the relationship of the church and the state, which is a valid question, and one that hopefully we will be able to answer if we can get our podium to not fall over on us and be comfortably high. The best way to approach this topic, and the reason I picked this topic, is because I think the book of Esther is infinitely important for understanding the relationship of God's people with the secular state. And the assumption I'm making is that we live in a secular state. I don't think it's an unfair assumption to make. So the book of Esther is an important book to study, and we'll find out why. But I want to make sure that we understand a couple of calm ground rules first. This is going to be a survey, a literary survey of the book of Esther. We've got less than an hour, so we've got a lot of ground to cover. One of the main things I think we need to understand when we're studying biblical narrative, especially Old Testament narrative, is to keep in mind how narrative works. We hold that the Holy Scripture is the infallible Word of God, that this is revelation from God and is truth. So let me just set that up right up front. We hold the book of Esther to be truth. That does not mean, though, that we can't study it as literature. The Bible is good literature. It is very good storytelling. Sometimes in our current society that we're in, when we talk about story and literary analysis and the Bible, some people start to they get uncomfortable. They say, well, if you're talking about it as story and literature, then you must not be talking about it being truth. Well, those are not mutually exclusive. You can have truth that is told in a really well-crafted literary style, and that's what we have in the book of Esther. So I just kind of want to set that framework up front. As then in literary analysis, we have the advantage of looking at it like we would any good piece of literature. And here's one very important key to studying literature and narrative, especially biblical narrative, and it's what I call the economy of language. When you write, when you communicate, you only have so much time, so much space to be able to communicate. So we tend to not use extra words. We tend to have things fit, and we use certain things to tell the certain story. We don't add extra bits in. If you watch a good movie or read a good book, more often than not, every single scene, every single conversation serves a purpose. So when we're talking about biblical narrative, I think we can think about it in the same way. God didn't just randomly have various human authors record random events throughout the history of Israel. Those events that have been revealed to us in Holy Scripture were revealed for a purpose. In the story of Esther, the conversations, the interactions that take place are conversations and interactions that serve a purpose. There is a divine narrative that is being served. It's a divine purpose to the narrative. And I think it is very safe to say that everything, every conversation, every interaction in the book of Esther fits to that narrative. So that means that we can look at it. We can say, okay, what conversations were included versus what conversations were not? What interactions have been discussed versus other interactions that the author of Esther is completely silent on? And so we're going to be talking about some of those elements and interactions as we look at this book this afternoon. So if you have your handout, and if you don't, there's some extras up front there. Basically, what I've done is provided you a basic analysis of the book of Esther. Just talking about some of the main literary fields of discussion. And so we're going to kind of walk through this. I'm going to expound upon it. so we can better understand what is going on in this story. Now, how many of you have read the book of Esther? Okay, how many of you remember what the story is about? Okay, this is good. This is good. Not everybody has read the book of Esther, but most people have, and especially in this room, this is good. Do you remember all the details? Yeah, that's where we get a little bit shaky. And a lot of the meaning in a book like Esther is in some of these really intricate and nuanced details, and this is going to be a lot of fun, hopefully. So let's look first about characters. Anytime we talk about a story, it's important to understand the characters of the story. In this case, we have a king, King of Persia, King Ahasuerus. And in general, his character is presented to us as somebody who, he likes a good party. He likes to throw feasts. He likes to attend feasts. He likes to drink wine. And he tends to be one that doesn't make decisions without consulting others. Whether that means he is weak politically or maybe insecure, we don't quite know, but we know that he doesn't make decisions without consulting other people on those decisions, at least not frequently. Then we have Queen Vashti, who we only get a little bit about her in this in the account of Esther, but we know that she, at least at one point in time, in one occasion, decided to not submit to the will of the king, and that had some consequences. And then we have Hadassah, who is also known as Esther. She's the heroine of our story. She is somebody that is, she's a Jew. She is the cousin of this next character that we're going to talk about, Mordecai. And she is described as somebody who's great, a great beauty and pleasant to look at. So she's hot stuff, if you will, to use common parlance. But she proves that she has more going on to her than just that. She has courage and she has political savvy. Then you have Mordecai, who is presented as the hero of the story. He's the cousin of Hadassah. He proves himself to be somebody who is loyal not only to his people, the Jews, but also to the king. And we'll talk about some other qualities that I think he has when we wrap things up. And then you have Haman, who is the main villain. If you were on the Feast of Purim as a Jew, every time his name came up in the reading and recounting of Esther, everybody would yell and insult him and just boo and hiss and say how evil of a man he is. His primary allegiance seems to be to himself. His own gain, his own prestige, his own honor, his own sense of self-worth. And then you have multiple supporting characters, namely servants and eunuchs within the king's court. So those are the major players. Now let's think about the setting. The period, the place that we're in the book of Esther is the kingdom of Persia. This is after Assyria captured Israel, after Babylon captured Judah. This is after the first exile, the first period of where Jewish exiles had come from captivity back into the land under Zerubbabel. And this is in the period prior to the returns under Ezra and Nehemiah. So this is a period, it's after Daniel, but it's before Nehemiah, it's before Ezra. And so that's kind of the period of time that we're talking about in terms of biblical history. The only three books that cover periods of time later than Esther are Nehemiah and Malachi in the last three chapters, four chapters of the book of Ezra. And then this is a period of time right before Alexander the Great and that whole period, and then what we call the silent period, the intertestamental period between the testaments. So let's think about the story of Esther. Let's walk through the plot. Pretty fascinating story, really, and it's very well told. It starts with King Ahasuerus. He's a powerful man in the kingdom, and he calls a 180-day feast. He wants to show off his riches. He wants the people in his kingdom to know that he's the stuff, that he's got the power, that he's got the wealth. He wants people to see it. During this time of celebration, his wife, Queen Vashti, is called to the court. He wants to show her off. Along with his riches, he wants people to see his wife. He wants to show her off. She refuses, and he interprets that act to be something of insubordination. He doesn't really know what to do. He's rather indecisive initially, but he has these people around him, advisors around him that say, hey, if your wife gets away with being insubordinate to you, what about all the other guys throughout the kingdom? Their wives are going to be insubordinate to them too. That's not only bad for them and their household, that could ruin the kingdom. Can't stand for that. And he says, maybe you're right. And so he exiles her, banishes her, dethrones her, defrocks her. We don't get any sense that she was executed, but she at least was not in any kind of position of influence in the royal court anymore. So we get to the second chapter. Some time has passed, about 4 years. King Ahasuerus is no longer angry about the situation with Queen Vashti, and said that some of his young men around him say, you know, it's about time you got a queen again. It's been a while. Why don't you get a queen? And he says, that's a good idea. So they start a selection process. And edicts are sent out to all the corners of the land for every province to send some beautiful young woman to the king's court to enter a period of about 1 year of preparation, of beautification, of probably learning etiquette and courtly demeanor and everything else, so they can be prepared to be part of the royal court. Esther is part of this. Her cousin, she's been living with her cousin Mordecai because her parents had since passed away. He says, hey, this is a good opportunity for you. Just don't tell them you're a Jew. We don't really know why he was worried about telling them that she was a Jew necessarily, but he counsels her to stay quiet about her heritage. She complies, and she joins the king's harem and goes through this period of beautification. During this period of time, we find out that she basically befriends one of the king's eunuchs. His name's Hegai, and she trusts him, and he seems to take some kind of a liking to her, and he basically shows her what she needs to do to prepare to impress the king. So it's said that Esther basically follows his advice. Whatever he tells her to do, he does it. So somewhere along the line, she's developed a relationship with just one of the servants within the court, follows his advice. The king becomes rather besmitten with her, and he selects her. Now we have Queen Esther. And there's a feast that's thrown in her honor to celebrate the fact that the king now has a queen. Sometime after this feast, her cousin Mordecai, who's hanging out in the king's gate where a lot of official business would have taken place, Mordecai learns of a plot that's being hatched by two servants, by two eunuchs that are hanging out in the court. He overhears that they're planning on basically assassinating the king. Foreshadowing that happens about 10 years later, but not by these two guys. But Mordecai learns of this. He's able to directly inform Queen Esther. They are able to have a conversation directly. It's important that at that point in time, that we remember it. We realize, again, the economy of narrative. In the narrative at this point, Mordecai and Queen Esther have a direct conversation. And she can relay this information to her, share with her what he's heard about this plot against the king. And she's able to then report it to the king. She does so in the name of Mordecai, so that Mordecai gets credit for it. And these two eunuchs are arrested and executed, and all is well. Until chapter 3. About 5 years have passed now, since the previous chapter. And a man named Haman comes on the scene. This is where all the Jews, if they're reading this at Purim, would start booing and yelling and shouting and carrying on. But he's promoted over all the other officials in the royal court. We don't really know much about him. No reason to jeer him at this point in time in the story, at least if you don't have any foreknowledge of what's to come. But he's presented as one who wants to flaunt his position. It's said that he would go through the king's gate, and he would want all the servants to pay homage to him, to bow down to him. It doesn't say anything about worshiping him. They just want to him. He wants people to show him deference and respect. We get no sense that Interestingly, we get no sense that the kind of homage that he is asking for would be contrary to any divine standard. This is not necessarily him asking to be worshipped. That would kind of be treasonous, since he's not the king. And even in this day and age in the kingdom of Persia, the king wouldn't have even accepted divine status. But interestingly enough, Mordecai refuses to pay homage. We don't really know why. We just know that he doesn't want to bow down to Haman. For some reason, he doesn't want to show respect to the highest ranking official in the Persian Empire. If you ask me, a little bit short-sighted on his part, especially since he didn't seem to follow the advice he had given Esther. He told Esther, don't tell people you're a Jew, keep that hidden. But there's these servants around him, we read in chapter 3, they knew that Mordecai was a Jew. His heritage was known, and he's refusing to bow to Haman. They confront him on it and say, dude, what's up? Come on, this guy deserves some respect. What are you doing? And he doesn't. And they tell on him. They're perhaps out of political posturing and opportunism. They let Haman know, hey, this guy, this Jew over here, it's not showing you respect. Well, this really, really gets to Haman. He does not like this. He doesn't want to only humiliate Mordecai, but he decides, you know what, the only possible recourse is to wipe out all the Jews. That's a really good idea. One guy doesn't bow to me, so I'm going to wipe out his entire heritage. A little bit of an overreaction, I would say, but it's the reaction that Haman had. He goes to the king and gets the king to agree that in a year's time, a proclamation or an edict will go out that in a year's time, that the Jews can be slaughtered, annihilated, completely destroyed, utterly decimated, even more than decimated, completely destroyed. He's given the king's signet ring to endorse this edict, and the edict goes out to all the corners of the empire. We get to chapter 4. Mordecai learns of this edict, and he laments, obviously. It's kind of his fault. He wasn't thinking very politically. He's very short-sighted, and he's lamenting, sackcloth and ashes. And because he's lamenting in sackcloth and ashes, he's now barred from entering the king's gate. He can't go to that area. He's not appropriately attired. He's not decent to be in that place of political prestige. And Queen Esther, around this time, learns of the edict as well. She learns of Mordecai in sackcloth and ashes, not able to go to the king's gate. Remember when Mordecai learned of the plot, right? Queen Esther and Mordecai were able to speak directly because he had access to the king's gate. He's barred himself. He has removed himself from being able to access the king's gate of his own volition. Queen Esther learns of the predicament, sends him clothing. Why do you think she would have sent him new clothes? So he can come to the king's gate. She wants to talk to him. She's trying to have a conversation with her cousin about what's coming, about what is going to be done to their people. But again, Mordecai, a bit short-sighted, says, no, I'm not going to take these clothes.
What if it was his intention to not do that because he didn't want the queen to be seen talking to him? And except for the clothing, he had to come, and then
That could have been possibly a reason. We don't get any sense from the narrative that was a rationale. And good storytelling, which I contend Esther is, guides you along a line of thinking without you having to make large leaps. In the previous chapters, they were able to speak directly. He specifically said to be barred from the king's gate because of his attire. She sends him attire. He refuses the attire, and then the next step in the story, they converse through a servant. She still is going to have this conversation with Haman, but she's going to have to go about it the hard way, the risky way. Remember those opportunistic... Remember, there's these two eunuchs previously that wanted to assassinate the king. You had servants that were telling on Mordecai to Haman. So these servants, they're plotting, they're scheming, and they can't keep their mouths shut. So Esther has to go to one of the king's eunuchs as a go-between. And then you have this whole exchange and conversation that goes on in chapter 4 is not between Queen Esther and Mordecai directly. There's a servant that's going back and forth, having this entire conversation. And in this conversation, you have Mordecai telling Esther, hey, go to the king, ask for relief. And Esther saying, yeah, if I go unbidden and the king is in a foul mood, I could be killed. And Mordecai says, well, yeah, I know, but maybe you're here for such a time as this. Maybe this is why you have risen to this position. Go anyway. And Esther says, okay, if I perish, I perish. So this whole conversation is going not directly between Mordecai and Esther. There's a servant that's involved. This is one sense of the bravery of Esther that we can pick up in this story. She's willing to risk exposure. It is so important for her to have this conversation that she's willing to risk exposure of the plan, being seen as being insubordinate. But we also see from this that she had a lot of trust in this eunuch. Just a member of the king's court. Somehow, in these intervening years, she had developed such a sense of rapport with this servant that she trusted them to be a go-between. So, she says, if I perish, I perish, and they hatch a plan. For the next 3 days, Mordecai is going to communicate to the other Jews. For the next 3 days, they're going to fast and pray. Esther says, I'm going to have the young women that are around me, my entourage, I'm going to have them fast as well. And after 3 days, I'll go make a request to the king. So in chapter 5, the third day passes. Queen Esther's plan is put into motion. She prepares herself and approaches the king unbidden. King Ahasuerus allows her to approach. That's a good first step. He hasn't called for her execution yet. And he's pleased with her. He says, whatever you desire up to half of my kingdom, it's yours. Perfect! She could request the freedom of the Jews. No, she says, hey, let me have a feast for you and Haman. Oh, okay. I like feasts. Goes and summons Haman, and they have a feast. He asks her again, what can I do? Any requests that you have, up to half of my kingdom. And she says, yeah, come back tomorrow. Let's have another feast. You and Haman. That'll be great. So we're kind of left, again, storytelling, we're left at this point a little bit bewildered. Why has she not made any requests yet? If that's what she's trying to do, why has she not done it? So here Haman departs. He's pretty happy. He's sitting pretty high on the horse at this point in time. He had a personal feast with the king and with the queen. He's been invited to come back for another one the next day, so he departs. As he leaves, Mordecai's in the king's gate at this point in time. He refuses to bend the knee. He hasn't learned. He's not helping his people here. I kind of get the sense that he's just being stubborn. And it has the potential to cause some serious problems to his people. He's being stubborn. He doesn't bend the knee. Mordecai is furious. Here he is on a high, leaving this feast. The guy that's caused him all these problems in the past is still not bending the knee. And so he goes home and starts complaining to his wife and to his friends. And he says, look at all the wealth I have. Look at all the power and prestige I have. I've got 10 sons. We're sitting high. This is great. Except for Mordecai, that punk. He refuses to acquiesce to my position. And his wife and friends say, you know what you should do? erect a gallows, which in this case would have just been a large pike, not like you're going to hang somebody with a noose, but you're going to skewer somebody on a large stick. Erect a large pike in the backyard, and tomorrow morning, why don't you hang Mordecai on it? Why don't you kill him? Haman's like, hey, that's a good idea. I like that. So he kind of goes to bed happy. And chapter 6. This night, after this feast, while Mordecai is sleeping, dreaming of putting Mordecai in a pike, the king can't sleep. He's just tossing and turning, and he says, hey, bring me the chronicles of the kings of the Medes and Persians. Bring me a history book of all of my political dealings. That'll help me sleep. And so a servant brings it, and they start reading it, and lo and behold, they read the section where Mordecai saved the king from an assassination plot. And the king's like, huh, that's right. Did we ever honor that guy? Did we ever give him anything for saving my life? And the servants are like, no. And he says, oh. Well, go out to the court. See if anybody's there. Any of my officials are there. Because again, he can't really make decisions on his own. So he wants somebody from the court to come and consult with him. By this point, Haman's returned. He's had a good night's sleep, dreaming of Mordecai being placed on a, you know, skewered on a pike. And he's going to ask the king for permission to execute Mordecai. But before he can, the king says, hey, come here. What should be done to the person that the king wants to honor? And Haman's like, oh, just had this great feast, then coming to a feast later today. He's talking about me. And so he says, well, he should be paraded around on the horse. The king's crown should be put on his head, his finest robes, so that everybody in the city can know that this is somebody that the king honors. The king's like, that is a great idea. Go get Mordecai, and why don't you lead him around the city on a horse? Why don't you put my crown on his head? Why don't you put my robes on him? And why don't you yell out to everybody in the city that this is what happens to somebody that honors the king? You can just see and feel Haman being deflated here. This was not what he woke up expecting. He went to bed with dreams of Mordecai and a pike, and now he's leading Mordecai around on a horse with the king's crown on his head. So he parades Mordecai around, goes home, and is lamenting. Now, the same words are used here for Mordecai's, or for Haman's lamenting, as Mordecai is lamenting in sackcloth and ashes. Where Mordecai is lamenting over this coming demise of his people, Haman is lamenting over a little bit of a burn to his pride. And the wife and the friends that previously said, hey, set up that pike in the backyard and kill him, now they're saying, huh, this might not bode well for you. This, you might actually be kind of trampled underfoot by Mordecai. This is not a good thing. And just as they're having this conversation, knock on the door, servant of the king comes and says, hey, it's time for the feast. So here comes Haman, now a little bit skittish. He goes to the feast. And we get this, then we get to chapter 7. They're at the feast. So second day of the feast was a long one. Much wine has been drunk. Second day, Queen Esther is asked again by the king, what do you desire up to half of my kingdom? And as a listener and reader of the story, come on! The time is right! Ask! Mordecai was just paraded around the city. People know he's a Jew. Ask! This is perfect! And she does. The payoff happens. She says, actually, I do have something. I'm a Jew. And my people have been sold to be annihilated. If it was just that my people were going to be sold into slavery, I would have kept my mouth shut. But they're going to be killed, every last one of them. And the king, indignant, says, who? Points to Haman. This guy. He's furious. He goes out to the garden, storms off. Cue back to the room with Queen Esther now and Mordecai, or and Haman. Haman's pleading for his life. He's on the couch begging Queen Esther to somehow save him. And just at that moment, the king walks back in, seeing him on the couch with her, and he says, "So you're going to assault my wife in my presence as well?" And sends him off. Actually, he doesn't quite send him off yet. Remember these scheming servants that like to kind of get involved and don't want to keep their mouths shut? One of them says, king, king. Haman's got this pike in his backyard. I think he was going to kill Mordecai on it. You know, the one that you honored like earlier today or yesterday. The one that, you know, paraded around the city, wore the crown, and Haman said, "Hey, what should be done to the one that the king honors?" Yeah, he wants to kill him on this pike in his backyard. And so the king says, why don't you, Haman, go hang yourself on your pike? And Haman's killed, executed. End of the story? Not quite. Next chapter, chapter 8, the king bestows the house of Haman upon Esther. Esther calls in Mordecai, introduces Mordecai to the king. They haven't actually met at this point. Esther is given, takes the signet ring that was given to Haman to endorse the edict to have the Jews killed, and says, "Hey, Mordecai, why don't you have it?" So Esther places then Mordecai over the house of Haman. Esther said, "Hey, what do you want to do about this?" And she said, and he says, "Why don't you write an edict to save the Jews?" So she writes an edict that basically says the Jews can defend themselves. On the day of judgment to come, they can defend themselves. The king endorses it. It goes out, and majority of the land says, "Yeah, we're pro-Jew. We like the Jews now." But enough people were still going along with Haman's plan that come a year later, 75,000 people throughout the empire, the Persian Empire, are put to the sword. So when all is said and done then, 75,000 are put to the sword, Haman's put to death, the 10 sons of Haman are put to death by request of Queen Esther, and Mordecai records all of these events in the chronicles of the kings of the Medes and the Persians, and commands and gives a command basically to the children of Israel that they're to remember this day as a feast forever. And it's what they have now is the Feast of Purim. So that's the story of Esther. There's nuances in there that if we just kind of quickly read through it, looking for some kind of big, like some memory verse that's going to give us a theological truth, that we're going to miss something. Like the conversations with these servants as go-betweens, and what are these servants doing? Their names are mentioned for a reason. You could have easily had Esther and Mordecai talking, but in this case, they're talking, it's specific, they're talking through a servant. Why do we know that? Because it matters to the story. It raises the tension. We see the bravery of Esther through that. But more importantly, one of the biggest elephants in the room of this entire book, we look at it from our perspective and we say, wow, God preserved his people. But you read the book of Esther and not once is the divine name mentioned. Nobody prays to God. Nobody asks God to intervene. And nowhere does it say that God spoke or God was involved in this process at all.
What about the fast?
People fasted all the time throughout the ancient times. But people would fast as a sign of their commitment to a cause. We don't. Could it have been a spiritually motivated fast? Sure. Could it have involved prayers to God? Yes. But at no place in the story is it explicitly mentioned that they fasted and prayed. Mordecai didn't dress himself in sackcloth and cover himself in ashes and cry out to God the way Job did. It just says that he lamented. Not that he lamented and cried out to God for deliverance. And here's the thing. What is that? Esther. Is that the name of our heroine? No, her name's Hadassah. She just goes by Esther in the story. Was her name Esther? Does anybody call her Esther? Not really. It's just what she goes by in the story. Her name is given as Hadassah, but it says Esther, whose name is Hadassah. So why Esther? If you flip to the next page, Mr. Vinson, what's that look like?
Well, it's on the page.
Work with me. Yeah, this is, Hebrew builds words off of three root letters. These little dots just tell you how to pronounce it. But you have three root letters that are part of every Hebrew word. The name Esther is just a name form of the root letters Samech, Tav, and Resh. Samech, Tav, and Resh is the word to hide. It's what we get in Deuteronomy 31, 16 to 18. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, you're about to lie down with your fathers. Then this people will rise and whore after the foreign gods among them in the land that they are entering. And they will forsake me and break my covenant that I have made with them." The time of Esther, this has already happened. They've already whored against the foreign gods. They've already broken the covenant. "Then my anger will be kindled against them in that day." God's anger has already been kindled against them. "And I will forsake them and hide my face," Satar. "And they will be devoured, and many evils and troubles will come upon them, so that they will say in that day, 'Have not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us?' And I will surely hide," Satar, the name Esther, "my face in that day because of all the evil that they have done, because they have turned to other gods." So here in the story of Esther, a recording in Holy Scripture that does not at all mention God, we have somebody whose name is actually Hadassah, who goes throughout this entire book being called Satar, the Hidden One. Where's God in the book of Esther? He's in Esther. Esther's a representative of God to his people in this book. So now think about it. Who's the one that's taking the risk? Is it Mordecai, the one that got them into the mess to begin with, through his own short-sightedness? Or is it Esther? Who's taking the risk? Esther. Who takes the risk? Who took the risk to get out us, humanity, out of our short-sightedness? Arguably, God did. Through the incarnation, through the crucifixion, and ultimately with the resurrection, God risked everything. God put it all on the line. And so in the midst of this period of darkness and despair and trouble, when the people seem to not even call out to the name of God, God is hidden. He's still there, but he's hidden. And he is still working to redeem his people. He's still working to protect his covenant people. There are several lessons that we can learn from the book of Esther, but understanding that she is the hidden one is one of the most profound. And I challenge you, go back through, even just through the synopsis that I've given you here, read back through it with the mindset that Esther is the hidden one. And the story takes on a whole new nuance. The hidden one is there. The hidden one was there throughout the entire story, but for some reason, the hidden one didn't act until a certain time. What does she say? She says, "If they were only going to be called, if my people were only going to be cast into slavery, I would have kept silent. I would have stayed hidden. But they were going to be utterly destroyed, so I had to step in." Don't we experience that throughout our own lives? On an individual level and arguably on a national level, periods of time where it seems like God is utterly hidden. Maybe because of our own short-sightedness. Maybe because of the short-sightedness of generations before us. But we look around at situations that we face as individuals, that our families face, that our church faces, that the world faces, and we say, "God, where are you?" And God stays hidden. Sometimes he stays hidden. But when the time comes, when his people are about to be utterly destroyed, he does not stay hidden. He does reveal himself. He does come through. He will risk everything to help us. And like Bishop Ackerman preached this morning, go where you're sent to go, do what you are sent to do, even if you don't get the credit. And that's where that's the crossroads we stand at today. Chapters 9 and 10 of the Book of Esther are very profound. Who's the hero of the story? Who is the hero?
Who receives the credit?
Who is the hero? Esther's the hero. Who did all of the heavy lifting? Esther. Who risked everything? Esther. Whose plan was it? Esther. Esther is the one that saved her people, but who got the credit? Mordecai. The short-sighted punk that got them into the mess in the first place. He's the one that writes it down. He's the one that gets applauded. He's the one that on the Feast of Purim, they celebrate as being the hero of the story. So let me ask you this. Are we willing to be used by God in our society to reveal the hidden God to save God's people? Even if we don't get the credit. Are we willing to be the hands and the feet of God, even when He seems to be hidden? Even if nobody's going to know our names? That's a weighty question. We like recognition. We like our name being known. We like to be identified with a legacy. And we have saints that we know of, but how many hundreds of thousands of Christians have died through the centuries whose names we don't remember? Are we willing to be them when our society is turning on us? Another profound lesson from Esther is that God uses us where we're at. If Esther had been a brat, if she had been a jerk to the servants, if she had been somebody that complained to the king on a daily basis about every trivial thing that she saw going on around her, and trust me, she probably saw immoral edicts being passed daily. But she waited for this time. She even says it. If they were just going to be called into slavery, I would have stayed silent, but they were going to be destroyed. So she was brave, but patiently discerning. We find ourselves in our own lives in various situations that we can intercede. We can speak up for truth. We can encourage our politicians to speak out for certain things. But maybe, just maybe, there's a time for patience. If we yell and complain and picket and boycott over every little thing, then our voice is going to be silenced when the really important battles come. So yeah, we look at our society and it's heartbreaking. How heartbreaking would it have been for Queen Esther for her people to have been sold back into slavery when they were starting to be sent back to the Promised Land? But she would have stayed silent. That wasn't why God had put her there. So we've got to be silent when it's time to be silent, so that we can be bold and our voice can ring all the louder when the time comes for us to speak up. I can't tell you what that time is. I can't tell you when to be silent and when to boldly proclaim. I can't tell you that. Thankfully, we have the Holy Spirit in us that can motivate us and guide us and propel us to make that decision.
In 1 Samuel 15, Saul is told to kill the Amalekites. He doesn't fulfill his responsibilities. He spares some of the Amalekites. Some Old Testament scholars have looked at Haman and Esther, the Agagite, and they somehow made a connection with Haman the Agagite to be descended from the Amalekites, so that the way to read the demise of Haman in the book of Esther is to see God's judgment and his fidelity to his promises and finally falling on the Amalekites through the demise and destruction of Haman. Have you ever, in your study of the book of Esther, come across that approach or that seeing?
Yeah, I mean, there's, especially with people that want to move away from historicity, they'll argue for it as being some just kind of a poetic completion of the history of Israel that started with Saul, the political history.
I'm talking about somebody saying scripturally.
We don't have a connect. I mean, from as far as people groups go, is Haman related to the Amalekites? Yes, and as far as branches go, but is there, I wouldn't go necessarily as far as saying that the point, any of the points of Esther are trying to talk about the completion of Saul's errant act of not wiping them out, and then the completion of it here in the book of Esther. It could be there. Yeah, it's discussed. I'm not opposed to it, but I don't think it's necessary, and I don't think that's the story that Esther's telling. I think the story of Esther is very contained within Esther. It has tendrils that move around and have touch points throughout the rest of the Old Testament and even into Christ's ministry in the New. But I don't think that's one of the primary drivers of the narrative in Esther.
Who wrote the book of Esther?
Tradition says Mordecai, but we don't know for sure. And my approach to authorship on books of the Bible is that it tends to not matter. It's important to some degree and various degrees for various reasons, but regardless of who ultimately penned it, the story is what the story is.
Would you also see in the destruction of the enemies of God's people a sort of picture of what God will ultimately do at the very end of the age?
Sure, and we see that when the theme of judgment and restoration threads its way through the Old Testament. We see that time and time and time again. And we talk about the already not yet kind of principle where when we see restoration, it's always incomplete up until the final restoration. And we see that here in Esther as well. There's a restoration, but are they brought back into the land? No. Is the promised chosen anointed one in their midst, the Messiah? No. So it's a taste of restoration to come without it being the full restoration.
So somebody comes to me and says, how could God possibly allow that to happen? I can respond, well, it's a sort of foretaste of what will eventually happen at the end of the world.
How can he allow what to happen?
The enemies of the Jews will be destroyed.
Well, when God speaks of the destruction of the enemies of his people, it's always in a sense of judgment. They're always being judged. Like even the conquest of Canaan. If you read through Genesis, Abraham was ready to go into the land of Canaan, but God says to Abraham, no, hold up. The fullness of the sin of the Amorites is not yet. The fullness of the sin of the people in Canaan has not occurred. So you're not going to go in there, because when you go in there, it's not just because you're going to be conquering land. You're going to be going in there because you're going to be judging the sins of the people. You're going to be my tool of judgment on them. And until they're ready for that judgment, you stay out. And so it's the same thing here. Until they came to the point, until the people, you know, only the people that came after the Jews are the ones that are destroyed. It's the people that were willing to actually, it wasn't wholesale destruction. They didn't even plunder the people. It was defensive. It was judgment on those who would strike against God's people.
I'm glad you mentioned that. Let me think of something. And they didn't even plunder the people. And some people have said, again, that's the 1 Samuel 15. One of the requirements of Saul destroying the Amalekites is that they were not to touch the plunder. It was given over in devotion to God.
Yeah, and we see times when they're supposed to plunder and times when they're not. So just because there's no plunder here doesn't necessarily mean that it's directly relating back there, but it could. Questions?
So speaking of annihilation, is it the same Hebrew word that's used when God speaks of it? It's the same word used in the story that's the Edict of Jesus?
Say the first part of the question again.
Mm-hmm.
I think so, but I didn't look that up. That's a good point. Something I'm going to look into, but I think it is. Other questions? Comments?
Well, I just want to say that was awesome.
Hey.
They don't teach this at ETS.
No. Should I be muting it?
But also, it makes sense of her wisdom. You made the point, really neatly, about why didn't she ask him, but her wisdom she displays is not earthly wisdom.
Yeah, she was patient.
And that actually makes sense, putting it in the context.
I'm going to watch that VeggieTales. Boom.
Next year we'll just watch the VeggieTales and we'll critique them against the.
It's so funny.
That's great. That's great.
So, one last question.
Sure.
In the Old Testament and under the Old Covenant and prior to Christ coming in, to the world. When their sin was full, they were wholesale destroyed. People groups weren't. Is that no longer the case because now Christ sits on the judgment seat?
What did Christ do on the cross?
He paid for all our sins.
The necessity, the punishment has been paid.
Doesn't it also state that he paid for all sins prior and after?
Well, until Christ came, there was no, the punishment for sin had not occurred. He paid for all sins, past, present, and future, on the cross.
But what you're just saying is that the punishment of their sin was their God's issue.
Well, in the past.
So that there has been payment.
Any payment prior to Christ is partial. Christ is the perfect sacrifice. And he is the perfect payment. Any attempt at atoning for sin prior to Christ was always a foreshadowing of Christ's atonement, judgment and atonement to come. And so it's incomplete until Christ, I guess is the best way to put it.
In terms of judgment, I think the best way to put all of the judgments that fall in the Old Testament period is in terms of intrusion ethics, that God is showing us what he's planning to do at the very end of the world. But we get it in sort of installments, so that what he does in any Old Testament judgment, he's planning to do to the human race at the end of the age.
Yeah, and the bottom line is, when we think about, a lot of times we're encouraged to think that when those Old Testament people were such brutes, they were told to go in and wipe people out just so they could get some land, and it makes them out to be like these militaristic evil people. But if we think about it in terms of judgment and the heinous, I mean, the sins of the Canaanites were even considered heinous to the other ancient Near Eastern cultures. They weren't just evil compared to God's chosen people. They were considered to be by the Egyptians, by the Assyrian Empire, to be pretty much the cesspool of humanity in the land of Canaan. It was the most vile place on the earth, in the known world. And so it's not like they were just, lying a little bit too much. They were doing the worst possible things that humans could do to each other. Child sacrifice amongst them, chief amongst them. And it's when they got to that point that God said, I'm judging them. And you don't really see people in the surrounding cultures in the ancient Near East saying, Those Israelites are so mean. You almost get the sense of their applauding. Good, good riddance. These people deserve judgment. They're heinous, evil, evil, evil people. But God waited until he came to, until the fullness of their evil was realized before he brought his people in to judge. And I think
the good news of the gospel is that judgment has been suspended, and today is the day of salvation.
Yes.
And that's the message that comes through the book of Acts.
Yes.
Judgment will come at the end, not now. Now, enter the Christian church and be saved.
Indeed, indeed. All right, final questions about Esther. We got to go.